Michelle Houston. I'm the Director of Web Publishing here at the Library. This is part of our digital culture talks, where we invite speakers to talk about their observations of internet culture. For the Library, the collecting of current news is a major area of activity. Traditionally, among other things, this has meant developing a major collection of Australian newspapers in print. In fact, with our state partners, we aim to collect all Australian newspapers. But our world is changing, and whether it's serious journalism, gossip, or innuendo, it's now happening in many forums on the web. So if we are to provide a rich resource for future researchers, we have had to evolve our collection strategy to include news published in the online environment. So recognising this, in 1996, we launched Pandora, our web archive. Pandora now holds a curated collection of online publications that have been selected by ourselves and our partners. Today's speaker, Stephen Main, is perhaps best known for his website or e-zine, crikey.com.au. And Crikey is one of the very early online independent news services. And I'm very pleased to say that in Pandora we have a copy of the first edition of the Crikey publication from February 2000, and we have regularly archived Crikey since that time. In addition to Crikey, Stephen also established the anti-Kennett website jeff.com during the 1999 Victorian state elections, which we also have in Pandora, where he published about 40,000 words, and many commentators say it influenced the final outcome. He has worked as a journalist for many of the major newspapers, including the Herald Sun, The Age, the Daily Telegraph, and the Australian Financial Review. Stephen has won a Walkley Award for Excellence in Journalism for his 14-part series called AGM Season 1998, where he purchased some shares and then attended the AGMs of some major Australian companies and documented this experience. He has subsequently sold Crikey, but he still works as a journalist for the e-zine. And the topic of today's talk is online journalism and its impact on traditional media. So please join me in welcoming Stephen May.
Well, thanks very much for that, Michelle. I have to say that I was very flattered in the very early days of Crikey to receive an email from the National Library saying that we want to archive Crikey. And I remember at the time thinking, wow, this is a major, major achievement. This is one of the first pieces of positive feedback that we've received in the first 2 weeks of Crikey. And that happened right at the peak of the dot-com boom. February of 2000 was literally at the absolute apex. And we almost fell over for the first year. And I still occasionally do go back to Pandora and just look at some of those wild and woolly early editions of Crikey. And I don't have any record of it anywhere else. I've got some of the words stored in different places. But to actually see the look of it on Pandora and how that evolved over the years has, for me, been a really valuable thing. So I'm very much appreciative of the National Library for the Pandora project and the depth of what they've got there. Now, I thought I'd just briefly take you through some of my personal journey at the outset. I was someone who just worked as an old mainstream journo for the Fairfax and News Limited in Melbourne and Sydney. Was a bit of a Luddite, didn't know much about the internet. But I fell out with... I'd also spent 18 months as a spin doctor working in Jeff Kennett's media unit. And I got a good sense of a good perspective on how different power players work in society. As a journalist, you set out, it's a very noble profession. You're out there to inform the public on things that matter for the public. And, it's a terrific thing to do. There's a real public benefit from good quality journalism, making disclosures, uncomfortable disclosures about people who are in power, and disclosures that will benefit the public. So it's a very noble profession. But I also saw, whilst working in that profession, that, you know, they have a lot of power, and sometimes the information can be distorted. It can be distorted by the journalists. It can be affected by the advertisers who advertise in the outlet. It can be affected by the opinions of the proprietor. There's a whole range of things that can influence that. So over the years, I did become a little bit more jaundiced about some of the mainstream media in Australia. And then I had my 18 months working for Jeff Kennett, and I got to see all about the power of political office. Now, you have to remember, this was, the, in my opinion, the greatest revolution we've seen from any government in Australian history. I mean, Jeff Kennett got rid of 100,000 public servants, you know, went from 260,000 to 160,000. He was the first person since William of Orange to sack judges. He gave Victoria the world's biggest casino, the world's biggest toll road. He cut 10% of the teachers and nurses and closed 300 schools. I mean, it was an unbelievable revolution. And being in there at the heart of that as a spin doctor, whose role was to distort the news. I mean, I'd gone from being someone who was meant to be telling people what was happening in the public interest to someone who was using my power, by dint of having all the facts at my disposal working for the government, to ring up journalists and intimidate them occasionally and try and influence and shape the way they reported the government. And I sort of reached a conclusion that if you talk about, you know, who knew what about the government, and you assume that the public service and the cabinet and the political staff knew had 100% of the knowledge, how much did the public know about what was going on? I reckon the public knew about 5% of what was going on. The political journalists who covered the round knew about 10%, but the journalists only tell the public about half what they know, and, you know, off the record and all those things we've heard discussed recently with Michael Brissenden's dinner is a good example of that. And the press secretaries knew about 30%. But it was amazing sitting in there how little the public knew about what really went on. And that did shape a lot of my early views about the fact that information is power in a modern society. And my mantra with Crikey was disclose, disclose, disclose. The more information you can get out into the public, the better it is for the public, and the public can decide. And it's the information gatekeepers who sometimes can be a not particularly helpful contributor to the way that function works in terms of maximising the amount of information which is in the public arena. So I, as a gatekeeper, as a journalist, at some levels you're a gatekeeper because you find out a whole bunch of information, but then you only tell your readers some of it. And as a press secretary in politics, you're also a gatekeeper because you have the information from what's happening inside the government, and then you try and filter and only selectively release some of that data and information and facts to the journalists, who then make their own judgments about putting it out there. And I guess the whole thing about the internet era is it's just this massive deluge of information out there, a lot of it raw information, a lot of it unsifted, and it's a fundamental change to the way that the public debate takes place now. So basically, I fell out with Kennett after leaving his office over a range of ethical issues. You know, I felt that he was using his position to buy shares in hot floats and make profits, and he was putting the shares in his wife's name. He wasn't disclosing it to Parliament, and I was his basic sort of de facto stockbroker in there, telling him, you know, helping him how to buy shares and all this sort of stuff. And then when Kerry Packer gave him a $400,000 defamation settlement after he'd made $100 million out of the Melbourne Casino project, for me, that was the last straw. And I was back in the mainstream media by then, and I reached the conclusion that I didn't think Jeff was fit for office. And what was I going to do about it? So first I did the write stories in the Herald Sun. That sort of, you know, I couldn't write personal experience stories, but I could write some stories. Then I leaked to Today Tonight what happened, and I got a story up on Today Tonight about Jeff Kennett's dodgy share dealings. That didn't work, and the lawyer sort of took a fair bit out of it. So then I went the full Monty, and I did the two-hour interview on Four Corners, where I gave them absolutely everything that I ever had up my sleeve about Kennett and his questionable dealings. Their lawyers took about 70% of that out, and basically said, you know, the lawyer said to them, look, if this goes to where Kennett's either got to resign or he's got to sue us, because this is just too hot. And the lawyers pretty much, you know, they did pull quite a few punches. And so Four Corners then went to air back in 10 years ago, and Kennett survived and just sort of bluffed and blustered his way through. So I left the state. I said, too good, punters don't care. I went to Sydney, and then Jeff called the election and he launched jeff.com.au and said, I'm a great internet guy. I'm really, you know, groovy and funky. And then he promptly announced there'd be no debate between any candidate. So he wouldn't debate the opposition leader. No minister would debate their shadow. No candidate would debate their opponent. So he embraced the web as a, I'm going to put all my radio transcripts up there and I'm going to publish all this information on the web. You know, I'm this guy who believes in putting information out there, but then I'm going to totally ban debate. There will be no debate in this election between any candidates or any of their opposition parties. So that was the end for me. I was sitting up there in Sydney working on the Fin Review, writing their gossip column Rear Window, and I just couldn't resist. I lost the plot, so I quit, and I announced I was going to run against Jeff in his seat, and I was going to directly put the information in the letterboxes of the people, because I had been foiled by the media before. The media had stopped me from getting my story properly out on Today Tonight. It stopped me from telling my full story on Four Corners, the lawyers, the defamation laws, all these sort of obstacles that got in the way. The Murdochs liked Kennett, all this sort of stuff. And I said, that's it, I'm going to run against him in his seat as a way of drawing attention to all these serious issues about his ethics that I felt had to be argued. And then unfortunately I was still in the electoral roll in Sydney when I did this, so I quit my job. I then tried to get my job back when I was ruled ineligible Stan. I couldn't get my job back because I bagged the media on my website. And so I had nowhere to go. And so at that point, I just put a 15,000-word essay up on jeft.com, which was basically my completely unfiltered take on what was wrong with Jeff and why I'd committed professional suicide. And this had quite a big impact. And over the 2 weeks of the election campaign, it had 115,000 page views, and it did affect the way the rest of the media covered the election, because I was pointing out stories they were missing or where they were being intimidated, and I was a political and a media insider who was armed with far more facts than your typical blogger or anyone who's got a MySpace page, and I was putting unique information, tens of thousands of words of it, out into the mainstream media via the web. And some mainstream media, particularly the ABC, which picked up the content and ran with it, then broadcast it to the world, and I was getting more traffic than the ALP's website in the final week of the campaign. So I had 115,000 page views in 2 weeks. So this, I guess, was one of the first examples in the world of an independent website being used in the context of an election campaign, which I think did affect the result. And the fact that Kennett lost by 9 votes in the seat of Geelong, you know, it was a real knife-edge election, means that 1,000 people, you know, although everyone's claiming victory, everyone's claiming they turned the election. But I do think there is an argument that that the media is very powerful, and I think I've directly impacted on the media. And Kennett had a shocking last week of the campaign. He got dreadful coverage, and that was partly me accusing the media of being weak, saying they weren't raising all these questions, and the media partly responded to that by being far more aggressive with Kennett's coverage in the last week. So after that, I decided couldn't get my job back. There was no Jeff, so I couldn't keep running jeff.com. So I launched Crikey, which was basically, it's going to be a continuation of Jeff, but it was combining journalism with activism. So I would run for boards of companies, I would go to AGMs, I would stand for office. I ran for Melbourne Lord Mayor, I ran in Kennett's old seat. I'm basically Australia's most unsuccessful candidate. I've run 33 times. And I was basically trying to, you know, use different tactics to draw attention to crikey.com.au, which was my new independent e-zine, which had no revenue model, it had no advertising. And you know, I had stuff all subscribers for the first year. You know, we got sued for defamation. We lost our house. It was a real struggle for the first couple of years. But then Crikey has come of age now, and I think Crikey's actually the best positioned independent online e-zine in any market in the world. So if you go anywhere and you say, name an independent online newsletter in your market, in your country. And, you know, I think more people in Australia would say crikey than any other place in the world if you ask for the equivalent title. And I'll give you a couple of examples of what crikey's got today. We've got 15,000 paying subscribers and there's 46,000 recipients of the daily email. People often say, you know, try and say it's a blog or it's a website. At the end of the day, it's actually an email newsletter. That is what the heart and soul of Crikey is. It's email delivery is the key. And we've got an amazing open rate of 90% of people who receive the email open it, which is a very, very high rate. On the website itself, 100,000 unique users, unique visitors a month, 1.7 million page views a month. When I had it, we were giving Google part of our website and we were receiving $1,000 a month from Google. Now, Google doesn't get any of the space and Crikey makes about $100,000 a month from advertising, which they sell themselves. So Google is good for little websites just to give them a little bit of revenue, but they don't pay very much relative to the clicks. And so Crikey's certainly taught me a lesson that if you really want to get some revenue, sell it yourself properly, professionally. Don't just take the little dribbles that come from Google, because Google makes, that's how they make so much of their money. They provide little bits of revenue to lots of little websites. And now Crikey's only paying Google money. Crikey doesn't advertise anywhere except on Google using their AdWords. So Crikey's spending about $2,000 a month picking out, you know, 300-400 words where if someone does a search for that word, Crikey comes up as a sponsored link down the side. So the model's changed. Since I sold it, we were receiving $1,000 a month from Google to let them have part of the ads on our site, and now we're paying $2,000 a month to Google so that when people search for words, you know, John Howard or whatever, that Crikey will come up in those searches. In terms of the email list, it is the best email list in the country. There's 375 people with aph.gov.au addresses who receive our daily missive. So if you want to hit the house on the hill, then literally Crikey is the place to be. 460 from the ABC, even 158 from Macquarie Bank. So you know, we are hitting in a very influential audience. And it's gone from basically being, when I had it, we were publishing a lot of anonymous material. I was allowing a lot of influential people to use me as being the fall guy for their anonymous rantings in some cases. Now, I would usually know who the person was, and often they were very credible people, or people who, you know, former politicians who wanted to say stuff but wouldn't say it under their own name. And for me, this is part of the... It's both a positive and a negative with the web, is the anonymity of publishing on the web. You can do a whole bunch of things anonymously. And that was one of the big criticisms of me when I had Crikey, was that I was publishing all this anonymous stuff. Now, at least I was a journalist, and at least people knew where I live. I had a house to lose, which I lost. And you know, I took the rap, and usually I knew who the person was who was publishing. So that person would have a record with me, where I would say, "Well, I published you before, and your information was credible. I didn't, you know, get sued over that one." So I'll publish that. But I do think that, you know, there is still downsides with the anonymity, and that the mainstream media requiring journalists to have bylines, requiring columnists to say who they are, is an important part of the credibility of you know, normal professional journalism. And I think that you know, that's one of the changes that's happened since Crikey changed hands, is that now 99% of the content has people's names on it, so there's far more attribution, which I think adds to its credibility. Crikey's now got, you know, about 24 regular contributors. Many of them are journalists, but the model also still remains this whole... Partly, is take the journalists out of the equation, which was partly my model, which is let the people tell their own story. So let the particular politician set out the argument. Don't have the journalist as the filter, because journalists, they really are the filter. And that's why John Howard loves talk radio more than anything else, because he can go on the radio and he can have a direct conversation with the community. And the community can ring in and ask him questions, and he can control it. far more than if he sits down with The Age or the Canberra Times for an hour, gives them a big long interview, and then they choose to put a particular headline on it, they choose to place it on a particular page which he might not like, and they choose to only highlight six of his 124 answers. So the politicians don't like this idea of the journalists as gatekeepers, deciding, imperiously sitting there, deciding what is news and what's important, deciding the pyramid structure of the story, you know, put your most interesting fact first and then work down from there. And the internet does remove a lot of that gatekeeping role that the journalists traditionally have played, and Crikey certainly relies on that model to a degree. I mean, we've got probably 10 professional journalists working for Crikey now, but I would say more than half of our content that comes out each day is not written by professional journalists. It's written by others, academics. We go to people and, you know, just say, give us 400 words on this, former politicians, you name it. So it is still taking the journalists out of the equation, which I think is a healthy development in some respects. In terms of where Crikey's at now, it's you know, as I said, it's profitable, it's sustainable. I think it's more influential than it's ever been, and it's becoming an aggregator. And the whole thing about the internet now is that there's too much information. We have a massive oversupply of information, whereas 30, 40 years ago, there was a shortfall of there was a shortage of information. It was the journalist's job to go out there and find information and put it out there in the papers, whereas today there's a massive oversupply of information, and so Crikey very much has an aggregating role. And I think that aggregating and sifting and sorting and providing context to all that information, pointing people to the good stuff and the useful stuff, linking up, join the dots journalism. I write a lot of these stories where I'll say, if you have a look at this interview over here, and you compare it to this profit release there, and then you go back to this Hansard and you look at this, and then you go, and you're often linking up four or five different things from the web. And the great thing about the email delivery and links is that you can send people to the original sources. But the story that will appear, the 300 or 400 word story that will appear, will have five or six links in it where people can search for deeper original material if they want, but it's just providing context and it's just aggregating information which is already out there. You know, it's saying this particular blog is good, go there. This particular comment by this guy in Brisbane is at the Courier Mail is worth reading, and putting it all together. And I think that that's the key to Crikey's success, is people are busy. They haven't got time to go sifting and sorting and finding stuff themselves. They get lunchtime every day, they get one summary, 30 stories, wraps together all that's useful and interesting in the world of politics, business and media, and puts it in one place. You can read it in about 20 minutes, and you don't need to know too much else. You can get away with not necessarily going through every newspaper, listening to every program, watching the 7:30 report. If something really big happens, the aggregators at Crikey will point you to it and add a bit of value as well with some original content. And I think that the originality is also very important, is that there's a lot of people who can just, a lot of blogs who will just recycle and respond to what's in the mainstream, but won't actually add any value. I think that Crikey does add some value. Now, a lot of people are writing the obituary for mainstream media. I'd like to put a contrary view to that. I think that the actual mainstream media in Australia is in a pretty healthy state. I think our radio industry is, you know, enormously profitable. John Howard's embraced it as the medium that he uses. I think radio in Australia is probably as influential as any market in the world in terms of, you know, the way that John Howard in particular, Jeff Kennett did the same, embraced it as a medium, that you know, you don't see shock jocks elevated in the political discussion in any other country like we've seen it in Australia. So the radio industry, you know, the internet certainly has not killed the radio industry. I think that the radio industry in Australia is very, very viable. In terms of free-to-air television, traditionally, I think we've, you know, I've heard the argument that we've had the best free-to-air television market in the world in terms of the quality of the content and in terms of the power. And I think that's right, that we have an incredibly powerful free-to-air industry in Australia. And it's no fluke that the two richest and most powerful families in Australia, the Murdochs and the Packers, came up through the media and particularly television and newspapers. I think that free-to-air television is suffering probably the biggest decline of all of the mediums, the biggest threats from the internet. And I think that there is a great worry that we're going to see a loss of quality journalism. You know, what's happening with the Sunday program, the absolute rubbish that gets thrown up on Today Tonight and on A Current Affair every night, I think is an indictment. It's not journalism at all, it's just absolute trash. And I think that apart from the ABC, which is continuing to produce fabulous quality journalism, that the business model supporting good quality journalism commercially on free-to-air television is in decline. And we are seeing their profits falling, we are seeing journalists losing their jobs, and I think the whole who killed Channel 9, the whole crisis at Channel 9 is a really sad thing, given the absolute power and the quality that 9 had over a long period of time in delivering news in Australia. And now I think you're just not quite seeing that as much. Newspapers, people keep saying they're dying all over the world, and it's true that, you know, Seek.com has now got $150 million a year in revenue. And that revenue has come, you know, almost exclusively from newspapers. So newspapers are having their revenue models fundamentally eaten into. I mean, they say that the Fairfax broadsheets in Melbourne and Sydney are losing an average of about 5 to 6% of their classified advertising volumes each year. So yes, they are embracing the web, and they've got they're picking up some advertising revenue from the web. They are suffering a significant cut in their overall revenues, and I think that you are seeing, you know, foreign bureaus being wound back, less investigative journalism units like we had. We used to have the legendary unit on The Age, the Insight team, not as nearly as well resourced as it once was. So I think that the newspapers are suffering. But interestingly, Fairfax, you know, is diversifying. I mean, in 2000, 80% of Fairfax's revenues were from major metropolitan newspapers. Now it's down to 27% because they've gone into the internet, they've bought radio, they've bought Trade Me, the eBay of New Zealand, they've bought the RSVP dating website. So they've gone all over the place in diversifying, and they're now expecting their journalists to go to a scene of a story and file for the internet first and file for the newspaper later. And I think that probably the best combination is online with newspapers. And I think in terms of where you can augment what you do. And the fact of the matter is that the old media does dominate the internet space in Australia. Have a look at the top 10 most visited sites, and they are all the old media companies. I mean, crikey's the best read of any independent, and we never make it into the top 10. It's 9MSN, it's ABC Online, it's the SMH, it's news.com.au, it's the age.com.au. So the old media has basically embraced the internet, and they own the internet in terms of eyeballs on news in Australia. Crikey, a few other minor players, you know, a few of the bloggers and stuff are sort of at the fringes, but it is the mainstream which is dominating it, and they see it as a way to augment their coverage. So your typical story in The Age now is twice as long online as it is in the paper. So the journalist, I heard an Age court reporter 2 weeks ago give a talk saying that my typical story in the paper is 14 paragraphs long, and my typical story online, the same story, is 26 paragraphs long. So I write my usual 26 to 30 paragraphs. It gets cut in half for the print version, and it gets run in full online. So I think that's a sensible augmentation of the coverage. And that was the whole thing about Jeff.com, was it was a chance for me to put tens of thousands of words out into the public arena, which you can never do with the confines of advertising space and the printed word. So I think the fact that you know, The Age and the SMH have massively increased their readership by dint of the fact that they are online and that they are being read all over the world. And a newspaper like The Age, which is outsold 2-1, more than 2-1 by the Herald Sun in Victoria. Now, I should tell you that the Herald Sun is the highest circulation penetration newspaper in the world. There is no other newspaper in the world that gets to 40% of households. To sell 550,000 newspapers a day in Victoria is unprecedented anywhere in the world. There is no other newspaper anywhere in the world that reaches such a large number of people in a relatively small population area. But The Age is absolutely kicking the Herald Sun's butt when it comes to online. The Age gets more than twice as many page views and visitors. So the fact that The Age moved first in 1995, they embraced the internet, they put all their content up there for free, and they said, here it all is for free, we're not going to hold it back. Now, 12 years on, after 1995, they pioneered it as the first website from a newspaper in Australia. They now have 50 million page views a month. The average visitor's on there for 6 minutes. Their overall readership and their overall brand recognition is vastly more expanded. Far more people are consuming The Age, are associating with The Age every day, but the business model around that is more precarious, far more precarious today than it was back in 1995, because they aren't able to charge the extortionate advertising rates which they traditionally charged online, traditionally charged in the newspaper. So you've got far more people reading it, but they're making less money out of it. And that is the great challenge presented by the internet, is that you cannot monetize the content that you put up there and the effort that goes into that content. You cannot monetize it sufficiently to actually properly resource really good, expensive investigative journalism. And it does pose the fundamental question, how should quality journalism be funded? And I, for one, think that the commercial model, the advertising model, is limited. It's got its problems to start with. I mean, I'd say a classic example is a big company like Woolworths. For mine, there should be a major debate in Australia across all media about the sheer market power of Woolworths and what they're doing, but you just do not see it in the commercial media, because Woolworths spend more than $100 million a year and are one of the biggest advertisers, and the former CEO of Woolworths is on the board of Fairfax, and it's just not a campaign that the mainstream media is going to run. So I really do think that the advertising support, the model of advertising supported quality journalism is in decline, and we should have a debate about how quality journalism should be funded. Now, the best quality journalism you see in Australia, for mine, is on the ABC. It's state funded. It's publicly funded. And I think that's a good way. There's a big debate in the States at the moment about why all these billionaires are buying newspapers. There's all these sort of shopping centre moguls and property moguls who are suddenly buying up newspapers. And it's just a vanity thing. These guys have made their money, and they don't want to buy newspapers to make more money. They just want the prestige of, you know, I own the Los Angeles Times, is what they can say over dinner with their friends and on the cocktail circuit. So the idea of philanthropic ownership of newspapers and funding quality journalism, you know, billionaires coming in and funding it, I think has a lot of merit, and that we should consider that as a model, because the internet is fundamentally leaking away so much of the revenue that has traditionally supported the quality broadsheet newspaper journalism. Now, just a few points about user-generated content. The whole Web 2.0 argument is that forget about the journalists telling you what matters, telling you what you need to know. Web 2.0 is all about user-generated content. Now, user-generated content is not new. The letters page in a newspaper is user-generated content. Talk radio relies on user-generated content. It's basically the listeners ringing up and putting their view out there, and the producers and the radio announcer managing that conversation, juggling it, getting interesting people to air, such that it is a compelling thing for people to continue listening to. However, the whole web user-generated content phenomenon obviously has changed the way that this all works, and we're seeing it with the whole phenomenon of blogging and having conversations online where people can post things straight away, they can react instantly, and then other people can respond to that and join in a conversation. Now, I think that the big media companies in Australia remain petrified by defamation. I mean, I as I said earlier, I lost my house, and it actually was someone else's content that I published without checking properly that caused that. And this is where it gets back to the point I was making earlier about anonymity, is that the unfortunate truth of unfiltered forums, where you literally allow anyone to come on and say what they like, often anonymously, is that it often quickly degenerates into a very unpleasant experience, where basically the any sort of civility and protocols around how you should address each other are quickly lost, and there's no quality control on that. So, and particularly with the anonymity that you can basically say what you like, hiding behind some email stage name that you might have for your web contribution. So, I'm a bit nervous about user-generated content, but I also agree that we shouldn't try and stifle the whole notion that people can have a conversation online. And it is a very healthy thing that that the feedback is more instant and people can contribute. In terms of bloggers, I've heard people say that, you know, bloggers are the new public intellectuals, that they can take a conversation and they can pontificate and they can organise debates and lead debates. Now, some interesting points about bloggers is that they don't break many stories. Sure, Dan Rather got brought down by bloggers. You've seen bloggers being influential in US primary debates, but I think that's a particular situation where a certain group of partisans, whether they be Democrats or Republicans, are going to vote on, you know, a presidential nomination. There's only a certain number of them. They're all very well informed. They're all passionate about politics. If a few of them have blogs and link up and actually put a few arguments out there, it can swing a vote. It can have some influence. But in Australia, with compulsory voting, we don't have that. And so the idea that one blogger or a group of bloggers will affect an election outcome in Australia is far less likely, because you literally have to reach the masses, because we have compulsory voting, you have to reach the masses to change them. And the masses do not go onto political blogs and look at it. So for blogs to have any influence in Australia, they have to have a partnership with the mainstream media. And Jeff.com, it relied on the ABC and particularly John Fain. That was my partnership. And he put it out there to the world that there was this interesting website, and the world went to it. And I think you've seen that with the recent debate with the Democrat candidates with YouTube in the States. And people said this was a great example of user-generated content, where users submitted their own YouTube video questions, and they were then put to Obama and Hillary and the other candidates, and they had to answer them. Now, that was a partnership with CNN. So the YouTube people all put their questions in. There was many hundreds submitted. Only 30 of them got a go because the CNN people quality controlled it. They chose what was interesting, and then CNN also broadcast it live. So it was a partnership between the user generation, people submitting through YouTube, and then traditional old big media, CNN, actually packaging it up and putting it out there for the world to see. In terms of the bloggers, the best role that the bloggers have got, I think, is that monitorial role, where they chip away at big media, and sometimes they can be too adversarial. Sometimes bloggers see it as their role as to tear down big media and to eat into the public trust of big media. And journalists don't have a particularly high reputation to start with. They rate, you know, around the used car salesman and real estate agents in terms of whether the public trusts them. And a lot of bloggers see it as their role is to continually challenge whatever is put up by the mainstream. And there was an interesting recent fight between Dennis Shanahan and a group of bloggers, which prompted The Australian to come out with an editorial and a whole feature on a Saturday attacking bloggers, highlighting this whole thing about it's the cult of the amateur. They don't know what they're talking about. They never break a story, and all they ever do is carp and moan. And I think the bloggers have to be careful about that, is that there is too much cynicism attacking the mainstream media. But bloggers do pose that useful monitorial role. And Crikey did that as well. We spent a lot of time at Crikey pointing out the foibles and the conflicts of the mainstream media, individual biases of journalists, backgrounds of where they got it wrong. I mean, for instance, the media is hopeless at ever correcting or apologising. So bloggers and other watchdog sites coming out and doing it for them is a useful role. I also think that with the decline of civics, and it is one of the sad facts of life that we do have a decline of civics in our society, that blogs can continue the public debate, that you can go onto a blog and you can actually have a debate about a political question or something else, and that's a healthy thing. And that, you know, traditional public forums where that might have happened in the past aren't happening as much anymore, but bloggers can continue to have that debate with the community. I'm probably running out of time, just a couple of comments on Google. I do use Google a lot, but I have to say that I'm a little bit of a skeptic as well about the whole notion of a machine telling people what is important. And if you think about what's on Google and what's not, there's an overwhelming amount of not great quality information that is on Google, and there's still too much great information, great databases, whether it's libraries, whether it's governments, whether it's universities, that don't have their information on Google. And I think that the way that the Google system can be gamed, where you basically, and Crikey does it now, we pay to get a higher ranking, there's a sort of almost fundamental corruption in that whole notion that you'll be up there based on just simply how much money you've paid to come up with a search with Google. There isn't as clear a separation between advertising and editorial as you would hope. Sponsored links, a lot of people just think that that's just a not paid for thing, that's just happened to come up there because it's an interesting link. And also the whole attack on the libraries, where Google comes out and says that they'll take a digital copy of all books ever published and stick it on Google. And I think that the idea of digitising content is a very healthy thing. I know that the National Library here is doing that. But I think that it shouldn't be Google that's doing it. It should be the libraries and the institutions themselves that are doing it. I mean, you can go to the National Library website. They have a wonderful online catalogue that you can search through. Far better than, far more reliable than anything that would be thrown up by Google. And I think it's a better system to have the libraries themselves doing that cataloguing and digitising and having the community going to the National Library site than having Google just seeing it as part of their advertising model. And yes, they have developed an absolute killer advertising model, but just having them doing it as that. And the other really sad thing about what Google is doing and the whole notion of everything's free on the web is that original content makers, whether that's journalists or whether it's artists, actually need to receive something for their work. And the idea of just putting everything up for free on Google and relying on a machine to rank you, I think is fundamentally eating away at the notion of rewarding the content makers appropriately, be they the artists or be they the journalists. Now, a couple of concluding comments. I think that the internet fundamentally assists the craft of good journalism. I use the internet all the time. I use Google all the time. I bumped into Robert Doyle on the plane coming up today, former Liberal leader in Victoria, and he was saying that it was fantastic for him as a politician to be able to instantly check what John Brumby or John Howard said in that particular transcript from that particular Hansard, what the submission was to that particular committee. The amount of information that's out there that is readily and quickly checkable is a great thing for journalists. It's a great thing for politicians hoping to launch an attack on another politician. It's good for the accountability model overall. There is more information out there. You are accountable for what you said. You can't, you say something publicly, it's there forever on the internet. It can't be hidden away and changed. And I think it's great also that the internet increases the audience for journalism. That massively. It does mean that any punter can become a journalist. Anyone can self-publish. Journalists have lost their monopoly over publishing. And I think that's a healthy thing. I did it myself through Jeff when I fell out with the traditional mainstream media system, which has certainly got plenty of flaws which shouldn't be relied on. However, the internet does fundamentally undermine the revenues of journalism, and I think that's a real worry. And I do wonder how great investigative journalists in the future, teams of them, are going to get properly funded with this whole everything's free on the internet mentality. Surprisingly, in Australia, there is still very little standalone online journalism. I mean, you've got blogs, you've got Crikey, which is a standalone, but the vast majority of online journalism in Australia is in partnership with or produced by the old media, just with their websites, which are adjuncts to their old media productions. I mean, the ABC has a fantastic record on podcasts. They are producing, the popularity of their podcasts right around the world is phenomenal. They have absolutely got that whole notion of packaging up their programming into a downloadable format onto iPods and computers, and their traffic, their audience, has increased exponentially as a result of the way they've embraced the internet medium from that. As I said earlier, big dangers in anonymity and just the amount of trash which is on the web, anonymous trash, I think is disappointing and a bit of a worry. The lack of quality control. I mean, even Wikipedia is a fantastic concept, but you know, the idea that anyone can go in there and edit, and with Wikiscanner, with the amount of people we've seen revealed going in there and doing it, wasting their time doing it, I think is pretty unhelpful. I've never posted anything on Wikipedia. I've got a couple of issues with my entry on there, but I've just said that that's the internet. You can't control it. You know, it's like Rupert Murdoch. When he's the greatest control freak in history. You can't work for Murdoch on a newspaper and ever say anything critical about him. But he then buys MySpace, and before he knows it, there's 50 Rupert Murdochs on MySpace, all claiming to be Rupert. So he literally lost control of the medium. He's bought a medium that he can't control. Just like Jeff Kennett set up Jeff.com, these great dictators, these people who love to control everything, embracing this medium that you can't control. I mean, John Howard goes on YouTube, does his announcement on climate change, and then all this bile gets posted in the posts underneath. Again, it's a medium you can't control, and that's got some good and bad things about it. Look, I've probably gone way over time, so we better have time for some questions. So I'll stop at this point, and I had a few more things to say, but look, I've gone over time. So I always find that these forums are good for accountability. If you're a newspaper journalist, there's the Press Council. If you're a radio or TV journalist, there's the Broadcasting Authority. But on the internet, we have no watchdog except for the viewers or the readers. So feel free to get up and ask as many tough and aggressive questions as you like, and I will definitely take it on board, because this is the best account. These sort of forums are the best accountability mechanism that we have at Crikey. So who wants to open the betting? Up the back. No, I think it's got easier over the years to get information, because Crikey's credibility has risen every year and its audience has risen every year. And now people clamour to get into Crikey because it's seen as a way to reach Australia's most powerful email audience. So early on, I mean, we still get locked out of the federal budget lockup, which is outrageous, and I'm half contemplating running against Peter Costello in the seat of Higgins. I mean, you know, you can lock me out of the lockup, but you can't lock me out of Higgins, will be my line. I always used to get knocked back for accreditation, but now Crikey's credibility has risen. So you can ring and say you're from Crikey, and you do get, you know, I think it's actually as good as major newspaper now. I mean, some people will still say, crikey, you said this about me 6 years ago, you know, slam the phone down. But overwhelmingly, I just think it's, particularly after I've sold it, it's become a lot more credible. They are checking a lot more. There's no more anonymous rants. And I think the quality of it's there, that more and more people are associating with it. We're having no problems. But if I was starting afresh, you know, it's like being a foreign correspondent in a country. You know, you ring up someone in New York, I'm from the Herald Sun, and, you know, you just get nowhere. And if you're a standalone starting blogger and you try and ring someone and get a response from a big company, you'll just be ignored. So Crikey's now fortunate that it's got a reputation that can't be ignored. But small startups don't have that same luxury. Okay.
Yeah. I would really like you to do something about Woolworths. Every week there is significant price rises. The one item, I've lived in Canberra since 1995, the one item, believe it or not, that only rose recently was Woolworths home brand 4-pack, 2-ply toilet paper. Went from $2.05 to $2.14 this week. And everybody watch in November, a month before Christmas, watch what happens. It is beyond comprehension.
Look, I did run for the board of Woolworths last year, and I ran on an anti-gaming platform. They've got 6,000 poker machines. Woolworths are Australia's biggest poker machine operator. Few people realise that. And I got 3%. I ran in 2000, and I got 58% and almost got elected. And that, I won't go into the details, but it's the quirks of how they present the campaign material that dictates that. But look, don't worry. I gave Woolworths a big spray on Virginia Trioli yesterday. In fact, I sent Virginia my... she's an ABC presenter in the morning in Sydney. I sent her my crikey story, and she rang me at 8 o'clock and said, as one of my topics to speak with her about, and she said, look, can you just wind it back a bit? That's just a bit... you've just really gone in a bit too hard there. I said, no, I always do it much softer on the ABC than I do in crikey. Crikey can be unhinged, but the ABC, you know... Great result from Woolworths, but yes, they have enormous market power, and you know, yes, they're putting up prices in the air, but it's a whole other story, which is not sort of that relevant today. So, yep.
Stephen, there's a story or an idea around that the web and online journalism and so on will basically work against spin doctors, and you had Colonel Rumsfeld's press sec, former press sec, recently putting out a book arguing that.
Well, firstly, I think it's a worry that we now have twice as many spin doctors in Australia as we have journalists, which is true. There is an enormous industry that has emerged around spin, and the reason for that is that something which appears to be editorial has a far greater impact on the consuming public than something that is paid for by advertising. So if you can get, if you're a big advertiser, it's far more value getting a story in the paper that says we've compared all the prices of these products and Audi is definitely the cheapest, is far better than any Audi ad saying they are the cheapest. In terms of accountability for spin doctors, I think that it is true. It's the web is good for accountability on everyone. Politicians, journalists, spin doctors a lot, because the information is out there that will prove the particular spin to be incorrect. But I also think that Tony Blair gave an interesting speech when he left office, saying that that over his time in politics, he really noticed how the sheer weight of the media, the amount of time he has to spend dealing with the media, is far more than ever before. It takes up such a huge proportion of his time. And that's why you've seen such an increase in the number of spin doctors by politicians, for instance, because the level of engagement between politician and journalist is greater than it's ever been. And few people realise that the Howard government is the most media-engaged government, I think, in the history of the world. Because you look at the amount of time those ministers spend on radio, always available for 7:30 report, late line, radio. They are doing an enormous amount of media, because they say the 24-hour news cycle has come up. Fox News, you know, Foxtel, Sky News, news radio, websites. They've got to be fast. They've got to be first. They've got to be out there. And they do need an army of spin doctors just to manage the 24-hour news cycle. So I think that, yes, there are more, but I think that dodgy spin is getting exposed far more than it used to be before, because the journalists and the watchdog bloggers and everyone else have the tools at their disposal, every Hansard transcript, every doorstop transcript, they can say, no, go back and look at that. I mean, the stock exchange. I've got every stock exchange announcement since 1998 on the ASX website. So I can go back and I can say, this guy was elected with this amount of the vote to this board back on this day, and it was Resolution 3. When I started in journalism, you didn't have that. There was no web. You didn't have any record except for what we had in the paper library at the Herald Sun or at the Age. So it's great for accountability, for spin and for everyone. Yeah.
Just
behind you.
You spoke of the decline of quality journalism, but is there a demand for it, or are people more interested in the lightweight infotainment type of stuff?
That is a very good question. You look at the Sydney Morning Herald and the Age websites for the most viewed story today, and you will inevitably see the scantily clad woman in the fashion story. just you will see the traditional tabloid or popular stories rated most highly. Kerry Stokes and Kerry Packer, the late Kerry Packer, do not want to put out the crap that they do put out on The Current Affair and Today Tonight. But that is what sells. It is the sad fact of life that 1.6 million people a night will watch Today Tonight with their fad diets and their breast implant stories and everything else, because that is what the vast majority of the public want to hear. So I think that the reason we need investigative journalism is that it will never be popular. Four Corners is rarely going to get more than a million viewers a week. A big feature in The Age exposing some corrupt practices is not going to be read by millions and millions of people, but it needs to be there. It needs to be there. And investigative journalism isn't necessarily popular, but the public import of it is huge. And that's why we basically need well-resourced journalism to function as accountability, just like you need a well-resourced Auditor General, just like you need a well-resourced court system, anything which works in the check and balance of democracy to hold those in powers to account, be it statutory bodies, be it media, be it journalists, needs to be well-resourced to do so, and they're never going to be particularly popular. So I think it is a worry that as long as it's commercially driven, that someone like the private equity owners of Channel 9 are going to say, when Weekend Sunrise, which is a lifestyle chat show, is getting four times as many viewers as the Sunday program, why should we continue with the quality long-form television journalism that a cover story on Sunday would deliver when they're making four times as much money on the Seven Network program? And that's why, partly why Sunday has been dumbed down to copy Weekend Sunrise. So it is a major trouble, and that's why I think alternative sources of funding away from the commercial media, ABC public funding, a great example, is a model that we need to look at. No. Links are the lifeblood of the web. You want as many of them as you can get. And that's why if you look at the bottom of stories on Fairfax or News Limited, you'll see a whole bunch of links to things like Delicious and Dig, which are sites that rate and recommend stories. So I think to the contrary of what you're saying, they would want to be in our section of what the papers say, because we're basically aggregating and we're highlighting what is good. If we started reproducing 20% of the Fin Review, then they would get upset because we're stealing their content. But just providing a link is what people want. You want as many links as you can possibly get. I mean, I'm launching a new venture in the next few weeks in conjunction with Crikey, and I've just done a new deal with Crikey. As part of this, I'll be continuing to write for them. And part of our deal is that I have a link to my new venture on the bottom of every story I'll have in Crikey. And for me, that's absolutely vital, because I want people to know that, you know, through Crikey and the 46,000 people getting the email each day, that I've got this specialist thing dealing in shareholder activism and, you know, running for boards and doing corporate governance stuff. So yeah, links are the lifeblood, and anyone who puts anything on the web wants it to be linked to. And links is the way that Google does its page ratings as well. So, you know, the more links, the merrier, I say. Yes?
Do you think that the internet has or will have an effect on the way politics is done? I was at a meeting of experts yesterday, and we were talking about how the web's going to be used to run the machinery of government in terms of how payments are made, you know, all that stuff. But do you think in terms of the way the political
A couple of points there. I think the web is proving to be very, very important for political fundraising, particularly in the States, You know, we're going to have our first $1 billion election campaign in the States coming up, and they found it's been very useful for fundraising. You go to any political party website, or you go to websites like GetUp or MoveOn.org, which is what GetUp was based on. It's all about energising your supporters. So you go to the website, it'll be a get involved, donate, give us your email address, come to this function. And so the web is very much about energising your supporters and mobilising them, getting them active, keeping them informed through email. And email, I still think email is the absolute killer application. Robert Doyle said the same thing, the Liberal leader on the plane today, that as a way of disseminating their information, email addresses was absolutely vital. So I think it's the web's important for that. And the accountability thing, where everything you've ever said or done is recorded, is very, very important. And also, this is where citizen journalism comes in as well, the idea that anything you do or say will probably be captured by someone with a mobile phone with a video or a photo camera on it, that the accountability mechanism is so much stronger, that if you do something in public, it will be captured and it will probably be then sent to a mainstream media outlet which will send it around the world. So most aircraft disasters you see now, you're getting really real-time, fast footage of planes on fire because someone's got off the plane and got their phone and they've done that. And the politicians are facing the same phenomenon, that anything they do. So I think the accountability mechanism of the web is very important. And then mobilising and also fundraising, I think, are three of the really big ways. Now, last question. We're already 5 minutes over. Nope? Oh, off the back there. Well, I argue for it in corporate elections because you get no one bothers to vote. So I think that, yeah. Oh, look, it's got its pitfalls. I'm probably a supporter, I think. I do think that it does raise the barriers for... I tried to set up a political party last year and, you know, we did okay with engaged people but had no chance of reaching the great unwashed when it comes to politics, unless you have a vast pile of money and you have a vast network of volunteers who can hand out flyers and hand out how to vote cards on the day. So, look, overall, I think it's good because it forces people to think. It forces people to get engaged in politics and to participate. But, you know, that said, you know, donkey voting and everything else, you know, it's got some negative things. And, you know, I'm against compulsion on a lot of things, but it's probably overall I'd support it on voting. All right. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Stephen. We're delighted to have you with us today, and I need to thank you for your kind words about the role of libraries in this evolving information environment. We, of course, agree with you. So I hope that you will join me in thanking Stephen for being with us today. I managed to get it recording.